On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio. This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB across the country. We're online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from This Is Money to talk through some of the stories on their award-winning website that they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, they'll be running the rule over what has been a terrible, but my goodness, engrossing week for British business, with bosses at Sports Direct and then BHS called to answer MPs' questions about a host of wrongdoings at their companies.
Do you think your company has outgrown your ability to manage it?
Probably, a long time ago.
Could you tell us whether it is true that Dominic Chappelle tried to take £1.5 million out of the business and put it into a company called BHS Sweden?
That is true.
Fair to say that you've made a profit out of this?
Yes, it is. I have made a profit out of this.
With all the Brexit mudslinging, it's actually been nice to talk about MPs as the good guys this week. But don't worry, we'll be talking about that too, and the impact that all the speculation is having on the pound, billions of which have reportedly already left our shores.
That's just on the thought that the UK could leave the European Union.
These are not investors in long-term future of Britain suddenly changing their plans. I think it's much ado about nothing.
Could sterling really drop 20%? And should we care? Also today, after a rough time of it for buy-to-let landlords of late, they got an unlikely victory in the law courts. And... oh, isn't that lovely? Isn't that lovely, Simon? Is that coin in your pocket worth more than you bargained for? One excited This Is Money reader got a limited edition Benjamin Britten 50 pence coin in his change, and it was worth, yeah, about 50 pence. So we're asking today, is anything that you have owned or got that is worth less than you initially thought it was? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
Bit of classical music to get the show started. They're lovely. So is there anything that you've owned that is worth less than you thought?
Yeah, there is, actually. I've got quite a lot of old records. So some of them inherited from my dad. Some of them that are my own. So, like, records that date back, you know, to the 60s and stuff. So I've got a lot of the original Beatles records. And also I've got my own Guns N' Roses Appetite for Destruction record. But it was originally released with a different cover, but that cover was banned. And a conversation with a friend a while back, he suggested that it might be worth quite a lot of money. And I looked it up while I was talking to him and I said, no, it's worth about 30 quid. And actually the same is true of some of those original Beatles. I've got an original copy of the White Album by the Beatles. Do you think, oh, wow, that must be worth loads of money? It's not. They sold a lot of that album. It's worth about 25 quid.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe in a couple of years' time. That's what I keep saying. We're in it for the long haul. For you, Rachel?
I've started gardening this week. First time ever. First time I've ever had a garden. And that means that I've watched a lot more programmes about archaeology and, you know, did you watch that show, The Detectorists? It was great.
No.
I've watched a lot more programmes about people just unearthing hidden treasures than I have spent time gardening. So every time my spade hit something, I thought, oh, hidden treasure. It happened a lot. There were a lot of hidden, not even interesting thing, bricks, tiles, which is always nice because that gives a bit of an idea of the history of the place. It's nice to sort of get under the skin, work out what it might have looked like before. But no, they were plain white tiles that were probably up sometime in the 70s. But I'm still digging.
Keep going. Keep going, Rachel. See, that's the thing. It's all about optimism. For me, it was commemorative coins from the Beijing Olympics that I spotted in a charity store. And I thought, oh, goodness me. It even had the little leaflet on that said it was legitimate. To be fair, it was in Mandarin, so I've no idea if that was true or not. £20 I spent on those, and they're worth possibly about £1.50.
Yeah, commemorative coins, they're a great investment. Yeah. We've shown that over the past few months or so on This Is Money, with all these face value coins that the Royal Mint sells.
Sharing ideas about money.
This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio. The team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Coming up is the pound about to plummet over a Brexit cliff. But first, what a terrible week for British business. And for once, this has nothing to do with Brexit. Premier League liars with Sunday League credentials, cultures of fear, companies too big to manage. We heard of death threats, of fingers in tills, laws broken, and even a worker giving birth in a warehouse toilet for fear of asking for a day off. With all the political mudslinging around the EU referendum, actually politicians were the good guys this week as they grilled the bad bosses from Sports Direct and BHS.
This really makes business as a whole look quite bad. I think the overall impression that the public watching this, you know, seeing the clips on the news, they're going to be thinking, yeah, who are these? The crooks and charlatans, and who are these people running some of our biggest businesses? After all, you know, Sports Direct and BHS are massive high street names. And when people think of, you know, the shops they visited in, you know, they think about who business leaders are. These are the kinds of people that spring to mind. Problem is, at the moment, the regulators seem to be sort of tossing this around like a hot potato. The Financial Reporting Council, who are meant to be the upholders of high standards of corporate governance, have basically said they can't investigate anyone but accountants. The pensions regulator originally said they only heard about the sale of BHS to Dominic Chappelle when they read about it in the newspapers, which seems absolutely incredible. And they haven't even given us an answer, the pensions regulator, on whether they are going to investigate. Really, this looks like it could drag on for a long time with no real answers provided, which would be terrible state of affairs.
Well, that was Edward Morgan there from the Institute of Directors speaking to Share Radio earlier. The famously media-shy Mike Ashley of Sports Direct was up first answering questions at the Business Innovation and Skills Select Committee. Staff paid below minimum wage, six strikes and you're out rules, which included for sickness, a culture of fear, docked 15 minutes pay for being 1 minute late, 0 hours contract, and yes, even one woman we heard giving birth in the loo. Well, here's Beverly Sunderland of Crossan's Employment Solicitors looking at some of the legal aspects of this, starting with the minimum wage.
What we need to remember is that certainly from April this year, the minimum wage is £7.20 for people over 25. So that means if you work 10 hours, you expect to be paid £7.20 for 10 hours. And what was happening was that the workers were actually having to queue for some time to be security searched. So they weren't able to work for anyone else. So by the time you added the working to the queuing and then divided that, you were coming out at less than the minimum wage. And now the penalties are quite severe for companies that transgress this. From April 2016, HMRC can fine 200% of the underpayment up to a maximum of £20,000 per worker. As well, there's this sort of six strikes and you're out. If you took too long in the toilet, excess chatting. One of the problems is a lot of these people were on 0 hours contracts, which means that the penalty for them is they just don't get asked back. What this has done is highlighted to the public that there are these practices going on and it might deter people from working there. But bear in mind, we're not talking about central London here. We are talking about Derbyshire, a beautiful part of the countryside, but I should imagine that jobs are quite hard to come by. So people probably don't necessarily have a choice. But hopefully the highlighting of this to this committee publicly and Mike Ashley sitting there and saying these practices are unacceptable, hopefully it means that these practices will change.
Well, that was Beverly Sunderland of Crossland's Employment Solicitors from Sports Direct. Boss, we did get some contrition and the promise to clean things up, but Mike Ashley stood firm.
Do you think your company has outgrown your ability to manage it?
Probably, a long time ago. I didn't build Sports Direct. Sports Direct built me. It's like going out one day and you've got a tiny little inflatable and you're in control, and the next wake up one morning and you're an oil tanker. I'm not Father Christmas. I'm not sitting there, I'm going to make the world wonderful. You just have to try and get a balanced view and say, as an individual, would you tolerate that?
We heard from a woman, this was said to her, and I quote, "If you want to get a contract, we can talk about it over dinner." She also said, not just one manager, but several.
Are you absolutely sure you can sit here and say there's no, what you would call, sexual within the office?
Harassment.
Harassment.
In terms of the allegations that were made in December,
yeah,
about searches, and you're talking about bottlenecks, do you accept that the company was effectively paying workers below the minimum wage?
On that specific point, for that specific bit of time, yes.
And you've now addressed that?
I hope so, yeah. I've got nothing to hide. Come on, will you find it 100% perfect? Of course you won't.
Well, were we satisfied with his answer that his company had grown so fast they'd failed to establish the kind of employment practices which are standard in the retail sector? Well, investors certainly seemed satisfied. Share price went up. But if Mike Ashley thought that was it, no, no. He's actually been asked to give evidence about BHS. Talking of which, just one day later, step up the boys from BHS, notably Dominic Chappell, chief exec of BHS, Darren Topp.
Could you tell us whether it is true that Dominic Chappell tried to take £1.5 million out of the business and put it into a company called BHS Sweden?
That is true. I mean, Michael had left the business at this point. So I got a call from my head of treasury, Harry, to say that £1.5 million had been removed via a manual transfer to BHS Sweden. My initial reaction was to, if I'm honest, was to call the police, because I wasn't aware of this transaction. Yeah, and that's a substantial amount of money. And this was during the CVA. We're at the end of the process. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, Harry, let me just... Because I know Lennart, the other director, who's a friend of Dominic's, is Swedish. So before we call the police, let me ring Dominic. I rang Dominic, and he knew about it straight away. And I said to him, that's theft. Now, if I take out all the expletives... He basically said, do not kick off about this, Darren. I've had enough of you telling me what to do over the last few months. It's my business. I can do what I want. And if you kick off about it, I'm going to come down there and kill you. And then he threatened to kill me again. And I know it sounds silly, but, you know, this, you know, apparently he says he was in the helicopter squad of the SAS. I know he's got a gun. There was a little bit of me that thought, and I said to him, you threatened me that again, Dominic, and I'll call the police.
Well, goodness me. Well, Dominic Chappell, the head of retail acquisitions, bought the chain for £1 last year from tycoon Sir Philip Green. Saw the chain collapse, of course, earlier this month. 11,000 job losses, 164 store closures. He made a profit. He deserved it, apparently. Sir Philip made £400 million in dividends. He'll face MPs next week. Get the popcorn ready for that one. Now, of course I jest, but this is a serious issue, isn't it? It affects thousands of people's lives, but actually these select committee hearings really have become essential viewings. Have we learned anything? Well, before we get into the specifics, Rachel, how damaging have these revelations been for British business generally? What have you made of some of those stories that we've been hearing? And some of them have been pretty outrageous.
They have. It's been remarkable viewing. I mean, often these select committee hearings get overlooked, but this has been, as you say, proper popcorn stuff. I wonder, though, what we know now that we didn't already, and I find that very troubling. There was an expose by the BBC in about April last year that had many of these allegations against Sports Direct in it, and they had all sorts of footage that seemed to back that up. The same with BHS. You know, we knew that the chap who took over was a bankrupt when it happened. So, one, why are the regulators on the back foot again? Why has it taken this long for MPs to haul the chief execs in front of them and to attempt some sort of accountability? Because really, it's too late now. I mean, oh, you can fine. But as you say, the shareholders are happy again. And, you know, no matter what you do now, it's no consolation for the 11,000 people who were BHS employees who are now out of a job. It all seems a little bit too late. But just so I've had my rant against regulators and MPs, but let's not pretend that we're not culpable here as well. How many of us question where the stuff we buy comes from, mm-hmm. the conditions under which they're produced? I'm not saying that that's an easy thing to do, but perhaps that's no excuse and we should all try a little bit harder as shareholders and as consumers to vote with our feet, and as shareholders in particular to ask questions of management, of the governance, ask about what's going on. It doesn't take that much work to ask a question, write a letter, get a bit more angry, and then maybe it might not be too little too late.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. How much responsibility, Simon, do you think we, the consumer, have? Sports Direct not alone in being criticised for the way it treats workers. We've heard from the likes of Amazon and ASOS also. Is it the fact that we're getting more demanding for goods that perhaps corners are being cut? Do we have any responsibility in this?
I do think that people have a responsibility to ask themselves a question when they walk into a shop. Why is this so cheap? You know, you look at the stuff in Sports Direct, it is super cheap. And some of that is to do with some of the very, you know, sort of clever business practices that Mike Ashley's put in place. He's hoovered up all these brands. So like a lot of the brands that are sold cheap in there, he actually owns the brands. He owns the whole chain, you know, the whole supply chain. But at the end of the day, stuff is very cheap. And if stuff is very cheap, then, you know, somebody's losing out. Mm. Now, to be fair to Sports Direct had this sort of employee reward scheme, a bonus scheme that paid out very, very handsomely for some of their long-term workers a few years back, and they ended up getting some very tasty windfalls. And we shouldn't forget that those stories were also written. But that also paid out, the person that paid out most handsomely for was a certain Mr. Mike Ashley, actually, I seem to remember. But you've got to look at, is that worth having for the fact that you're being underpaid and treated badly? And, you know, what's come out, there was this investigation, and The Guardian led a lot of the investigations mm-hmm. into this as well, you know, I think earlier this year, last year. And, you know, it has emerged that people are being paid very low wages, that they are being, you know, docked pay for being a minute late, that they've got these security checks and basically they need to get through those security checks before their shift starts and stuff like that. Is that any way that you want to treat your staff? And Mike Ashley can say all he wants, well, I'm the man at the top, I don't know about this, and now I've looked into it, I'm going to do something about it. We're going to make ourselves the country's second best place to work after John Lewis, kind of thing. But ultimately, it's his responsibility to build a culture in that business. And you've got two choices if you run a business. You can run a business for pure profit, or you can run a business and build a culture in it where you think that people are treated fairly and rewarded for coming to work, and that everyone operates in the kind of nice environment that they would like to be in and you would like to be in. My personal view is that that culture is very, very, very important, and that's one of the things in life that is important to me. Now, for other people, it's just all about the money.
Is there any way, though, that an owner of a company cannot know what's going on to this extent? I mean, the accusations by the Unite Union that someone gave birth in a toilet in a warehouse, this is shocking. You can understand incidents like that, perhaps not, but the six strikes and you're out, the security checks, and also what does this say about British business, especially at a time when we're voting for the EU and arguing about workers' rights?
Well, so there's two things at play here. Yes, there is a way that a boss could not know about that going on. You wouldn't expect them to necessarily know about every single little thing that goes on in their business. But it's their responsibility to make sure that they know what the culture of that business is. And you've got a scenario where either they allow this culture to build up, this not pleasant to work in culture to build up, and they know about it and they just allow it to build up because the profits are rolling in, or it's built up and they don't know about it. Well, if it's built up and they don't know about it, then that doesn't say anything particularly good about them. And yeah, we can tie this into the EU referendum. Now, look, without getting into any of these arguments about immigration and Remain, Leave or whatever, there is an undeniable element where a constant supply of cheap labour coming in from Europe, there's a lot of Eastern European employees at that Sports Direct place. The fact of the matter is that if you won't take that job and you won't take those conditions, there's another person waiting behind you who will take it. And that has, over the years, been something that we have not discussed properly and has led to this pressure cooker situation with people arguing about immigration. So it is something that, you know, does need to be tackled. Wherever you stand on the Leave, Remain argument, there is an issue there. The previous New Labour government admitted that it deliberately avoided having conversations about immigration and that that was a mistake. And, you know, so going in the future, I think probably we do need to discuss these things.
Rachel?
Also, at the same time, a lot of the kind of securities that ensure that people don't suffer these sorts of practices come from EU regulation, working directives around maternity pay, around the number of days holiday that we get, around the number of hours that we're allowed to work without signing something to say that we'll work more. All these sorts of protections that we have as employees come from EU directives. It's not to say, of course, that they would disappear overnight if we left. I think it'd be very hard to backtrack on lots of those things, and I don't think really that's the culture that we have in this country anymore. But that is where they came from, and that is where, at the moment, we're getting those sorts of protections.
Now, we shouldn't forget, of course, BHS involved in all this, and actually the two link rather nicely together. Mike Ashley admitting he wanted to buy BHS, also former owner Dominic Chappelle telling MPs that he had tried to arrange a rescue deal with Mr. Ashley, but it was Sir Philip Green that had stopped it happening. The Sports Direct founder has now been invited by MPs to give evidence on BHS's collapse. Written account, won't have to come back and attend in person, but it ties it all together. Are they the only similarities that we can draw from this?
Well, they're two very different characters. Mike Ashley is sort of famously a bit more reclusive, although it's actually hard to combine this famously reclusive Mike Ashley with the bloke you see on the terraces at Newcastle United. So I think that one has kind of fallen by the wayside a bit. There's a great piece by Alex Brummer this week about these two guys and saying, you know, about how they are the opposite, that Ashley avoids the interviews, the press, the public pronouncements and stuff, whereas we know Philip Green as the guy sat on the front row of the catwalk, and, you know, he's renowned for his colourful conversations with journalists and his critics. But there is a link between these two people, and the link between these two people is these are the guys in charge. I don't believe for one minute that Mike Ashley and Philip Green, who are phenomenally successful businessmen, don't know an awful lot about what's going on in their businesses and the stuff under their control. And the buck ultimately stops with them. And both of them have been heavily criticised, for justifiably so, I think, in this instance. And the buck does stop with them. That is the definite similarity between them.
Are we hearing some utterly astonishing things? Death threats, guns, some just really ridiculous stuff. Does that go on in business?
This is retail, OK? So just retail is notoriously cutthroat business, you know? You don't get to the top of retail without being a bit ruthless, OK? It is... The big retail has always been this kind of arena.
So Sir Philip Green up next week. One to watch, eh, Rachel?
It is, yeah. It is funny, isn't it, that we have these two parallel stories and it, sort of seeing it from just a narrative point of view, it's exactly the same. It's the rise and fall. We love a self-made person in the news. We love someone who's made millions. We were all happy to watch Philip Green on his yachts. We're all happy to see these incredible dividend payouts that Mike Ashley was getting, because, as Simon says, his workers were getting them as well. We all rejoice in those stories. They sort of, I think both of them, totally self-made, came up for nothing. Same as Lord Sugar. We like his story too. But it does not last if there's been sort of misdemeanors along the way. You can't tread on people and then hope for that story to go on forever. And as soon as it turns, as soon as people decide that they don't like that story anymore, then we get, you know, Act Two, which is the fall. And we rejoice in that one, I think, as a society just as much as we do the rise.
Just to go back, actually, to something else that Alex Brummer, the city editor at the Daily Mail, has written this week. It's a great line in the start of his story today, his comment piece on it. He said, "Rarely has there been a more depressing insight into modern-day capitalism than in the Grimmond Room at Westminster, where a motley crew of businessmen fought like rats in a sack over who was responsible for the collapse of BHS." I think that sums it up pretty well, actually.
Doesn't it just? Now, Rachel, you said about misdemeanors there. I imagine if you are one of those 11,000 former employees of BHS, 27,000 workers across 19 countries at Sports Direct Group, you're probably not feeling too great about hearing some of those stats. I mean, Dominic Chappelle, for example, paid $540,000 a year as BHS boss. Mike Ashley, worth $2.43 billion. Sir Philip Green, $3.22 billion. Now, we speak about morality, about crass capitalism, I think some of the papers called it this week. But doesn't all this speak to a larger problem of a system that means FTSE 100 CEOs, for example, on average earn 183 times more than the average full-time worker? Just this week, WPP boss Sir Martin Sorrell again coming under pressure after his £70.4 million pay package. Here's Deborah Hargreaves, founder of the High Pay Centre, speaking with me earlier.
At some point, you do have to say, when is too much enough? I mean, £70 million, is that really justifiable? You know, can you morally justify that? He owns 1.6% of WPP. He says all of it's performance-related. WPP's done incredibly well. Nobody's doubting that. Shareholders have done well in that company. And I think the company pays well across the board. But does it really justify him earning £70 million? I would argue that at some point you have got to say there is an upward limit on these packages. You know, what are we talking about in society if we're not trying for some better form of equality? You know, this is just incredible riches that no one can possibly imagine. Why does he need all that money? Why does he want it all?
Well, that was Deborah Hargreaves there, founder of the High Pace Centre. Now, Sports Direct Mike Ashley did admit he wasn't Father Christmas, but still.
It would be hard to make the case that we are a just society or anything resembling a just society today. There is massive injustice in terms of income and wealth inequality. Injustice is rampant.
So it's not just this side of the pond. That was Democrat candidate for the presidential elections, Bernie Sanders there. So Simon, quite simply, how did we get to this?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions been asked in recent times over inequality and how equal we are, you know, in the UK in terms of the relationship between the lowest paid and the highest paid, but also the relationship between the middle and the highest paid. And in fact, even the relationship between those people who are above the middle and the highest paid. And I think the middle, when you talk about the middle, it's important to look at, you know, what is the middle? Because if you just take an average, then that average is going to be skewed by the highest paid. If you take a median, that gives you a much better representation of what the middle person is. I believe median earnings full-time in the UK are about £27,000. Now, just imagine for 1 minute the difference between someone who's earning £27,000 and someone who's earning £270,000. Imagine the difference in how their lives are and what that huge gap represents. And then look at the fact that you can't take the person earning £27,000 and a person earning £270,000 and put them in two separate boxes. They are inextricably linked. The things that that £270,000 person does have an effect on that £27,000 person. The wages that they pay people who work for them, whether it be workers who are employed by their company, whether it be, you know, cleaners who come around and clean for them, people who help them, the prices that they pay for property, the money that they spend when they go out, you know, on the high street, in restaurants, in shops and everything, that money that they spend directly affects what the prices are for the people lower down the scale. And there might be much, much less of them, but they do have this effect where they skew things. And if you look at the figures, basically, that £270,000 in 2012, the most recent figures I can find, the top 1% had an average income of £260,000. So I reckon about now that top 1% is probably the £270,000. But they're not even the people earning the most money. There was a feature in the FT the other week about a couple who earned £200,000 between them, and they were complaining about, you know, how they were squeezed, basically. And you get these stories every so often. Everyone goes mad for them. Readers, yeah, just in comments just go completely crazy. But you know what? There's an element of truth in it. If you're those kind of, if you're living in a £1 million house and you've got, you know, you're keeping yourself in the style that you're accustomed to with the school fees and all those kind of things, you probably are feeling the pinch at that point. So then look at the people who are the CEOs, the people being paid £1 million, £2 million, £3 million. But then the people taking home £40-50 million a year, you know, it's, we have a huge issue with inequality where wages for the people at the bottom have been held down over the years. You know, in real terms, their wages have hardly risen at all over a decade. And then you have the super rich. And you can only have a situation like that for so long where you've twisted from a position where more of the profits are going to helping the workers to where more of the profits are going to the bosses and the company-owning class before you start to have real problems in society. And I think we're on the verge of having those problems.
We're becoming more aware of it, Rachel. We're talking about it more. The gap is getting bigger. Is there anything that can be done to even this out? Regulation, more regulation? What role can we, as consumers in all of this, and I say consumers rather than citizens?
There is plenty that everyone can do It never used to be like this. I mean, of course, there were disparities between the most highly paid and those who were paid the least. But these bumper pay packages and bonuses that chief execs are getting, it never used to be that big. Now, are chief execs any better than they were, say, 10 years ago? No. Did they not do their jobs because they weren't incentivized to do them in you know, a better incentive than they would be able to keep their job if they did it properly? No. So what has changed? Why do they need so much more to motivate them? You could argue perhaps that there's a lack of supply, that there are a finite number of people who can do these very important jobs. But there are, I don't know precisely, it's either 5 or 6 women in the FTSE 100 chief executives. Don't tell me that there aren't more women who could do those jobs, that there are a lack of, not just women, but it's a real sort of, we'll call it a niche demographic, who are in those roles at the moment. There are plenty of other people who could do them. It's not about demand. So, yes, there are things that we can do about it. Get more angry. We are all shareholders, or lots of us are, in these companies. But we just don't have a tradition at the moment of shareholder engagement. We don't ask those questions. Until now, there's been, or certainly until the last few years, there hasn't really been that scrutiny of these. There are remuneration committees who sort of all get together and say, oh, yes, Johnny Goodman did a good job this year. Another 40 million for him? No one questions it. This is, I think, partly the job of the media. I think we're partly to blame. There has to be more scrutiny. But it's not so hard as a shareholder as well to ask a question, or as a worker even.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome. If you've just joined us, I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year. This is Money, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NSNI. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, we'll be talking about sterling, the pound in our pocket. But before we do that, comment from you, please, Simon.
Yeah, just one thing I was going to say, actually. There was a story this week about the Burberry boss, Christopher Bailey. And their annual report was out that showed how much... He's actually taken a 75% pay cut over the past year because a lot of his earnings were linked to the share price. But if you go through the annual report, it details his earnings. So his total pay package for this year is almost £1.9 million. But that's down 75%. So that's down from £7.5 million a year earlier. But for the year to 2016, Mr. Bailey's base salary remained flat at £1.1 million. Although it was boosted by £464,000 worth of allowances and pension payments of £330,000. I mean, so the allowances and the pension payments like massively dwarf what most other people could ever hope to be their peak salary in their lifetime. The allowances, benefits and allowances payments is detailed in Burberry's annual report. It's there to promote the well-being of employees, allowing them to focus on the business. Benefits for executive directors may include, but are not limited to, private medical insurance, life insurance, long-term disability insurance, car allowance, clothing allowance, employee discount. This is not expected to exceed £100,000 for each individual employee, but the annual report adds, for the CC and CEO only, the maximum value of all cash allowances is £440,000 per annum, as agreed in his previous role prior to his appointment as an executive director. He's also entitled to receive the non-cash benefits. The value of these is not expected to exceed £20,000 per annum. That's astonishing, isn't it? That little insight into what someone at the top gets paid. Now, look, Burberry...
I bet reading that as a Burberry employee, you feel so much better.
Yeah,
you know?
But, I mean, the one thing I would say, okay, so his profits have dropped, but that company still makes £421 million a year. So it's a very profitable company. But the thing is, it's like, the question is, what do we do about this? Now, some of the things that have been suggested about what we do about this is higher rates of income tax. I don't think that anybody should ever be taxed more than half of the money that they earn. I don't actually think that they should be taxed more than 40% of the money they earn. I think that if you earn a pound, you should get the lion's share of that pound. So then there's wealth taxes. Well, wealth taxes are phenomenally unpopular. People hate wealth taxes. Even if they don't affect them, they don't like the concept of wealth taxes. Then there's other things like, do we tax inheritance more? Well, people don't like inheritance tax. Do we tax them on what they do? So stamp duty on property. Well, stamp duty on property is an awful tax. It's basically stalling the property market and hitting, even if you just hit the people at the top, hitting more people with a bad tax is rarely a good plan. But there is another way to approach this, which is to say to these people at the top, the elite, you know, the boss class, is you need to start paying yourself less and paying your workers more, because otherwise we're going to get all these things that we don't, that you don't want and we don't want, like higher income taxes and wealth taxes and all these other things. It's like there is an answer here. And if the boss class kind of takes a bit of control over this situation and starts narrowing the gap itself and paying its workers more, taking some responsibility for it, then we don't need to start hitting people with punitive measures.
Well, we're going to move away for a bad week for businesses, Simon. The heroes were the MPs, as we heard from the select committees, but from heroes to zeros. Talking MPs. We got more political mudslinging, didn't we, this last week around the EU referendum, including one defection, plenty of accusations, and yet more figures bandied about. 2 weeks to go. Alas, no cow auctions this week to entertainment. My humble opinion, the campaigns have been the far worse for it. But instead, we're focusing on that great British pound in our pocket. It's been tossed hither and thither on the waves of polling this week, we're hearing, slumping to fresh lows amid rising support for Brexit. 45 to 41% remain, according to the latest YouGov poll. Here's Tim Edwards from S&P Dow Jones Indices.
What's got everyone really interested and focused on it is the big move that we've seen in options prices. And the way to interpret it is that the market thinks there are some pretty big moves that might be coming ahead for the pound sterling. And that's focusing everyone's interest, and that's everyone causing everyone to conclude that, OK, Brexit is really weighing on the British pound. What you're seeing is lots of people wanting to buy insurance against some kind of event. The cost of that insurance is coming up. And baked into that pricing, we're seeing, OK, it looks like you're going to see some pretty big swings in the British pounds, stay or leave. As you get closer and closer to an election, polls famously get less and less reliable. The betting markets tend to be slightly more reliable. And the other side of this, of course, is that if you're in a situation where the market participants kind of agree, we don't know, then you get a sort of self-reinforcing mechanic where everyone is looking to everyone else to get information. Everyone's watching the market to get information and acting on it as well. So have investors been sort of spooked by the recent polls? Yes, they have, but they're also been spooked by the reaction to those polls, sort of self-reinforcing moment.
As Tim Edwards was saying there, investors shifting their cash out of the UK because we're hearing fears over the EU referendum. In March, 59 billion left the country, all was converted into other currencies, the fastest rate at which that's happened since the financial crisis in early 2009. Chief Secretary to the Treasury and in-campaigner Greg Hands says it's worrying.
We're talking here about £65 billion having left the country in 2 months. And that's just on the thought that Brexit, the UK could leave the European Union, shows that actually leaving would leave us permanently poorer.
These are not investors in long-term future of Britain suddenly changing their plans for long-term investment. If you go to the main car manufacturers, they've got five-year plans, introducing new models, all that kind of thing. They're not suddenly saying they're not going to do that because we might leave the European Union. I think it's much ado about nothing.
Well, it was Leave campaigner John Redwood at the end there. Clearly not as bothered. Should he be, though? Will the pound really fall 20% if we vote to leave? Those are the questions that you've been asking at This Is Money. And what have you found? Firstly, who is suggesting a fall of 20% and why?
Well, I think there's this question of, like, does anybody know what's going to happen? So estimates from the likes of Goldman Sachs and HSBC suggest a Brexit vote could wipe 20% off the value of the pound against the dollar's levels not seen since 1985. But there is then this comment that we had from Michael Hewson at CMC, who said, well, look, while these headlines of 20% drops in the value of sterling in the event of Brexit provide good fodder for journalists, which they do, it's true, yeah. They are speculative guesses at best and take no account of any economic push-pull factors on the other side of the equation. By that, I mean the exogenous effects of our European partners and, by definition, the euro. Look, basically, what he's saying is we don't know what's going to happen and that this wouldn't be a surprise. So when we came out of the ERM, that was a black swan moment, or he's classed it as a black swan moment. We didn't know it was going to happen. All of a sudden, boof, completely snowed under and we're out. Now, this time round, if we vote to leave, well, it's been on the cards that we might vote to leave. The opinion polls are suggesting we might vote to leave, that it's going to be very, very close. And I think that anybody with any sense who's looked at that has realised that for some time. So if we do vote to leave, it's not going to be a sudden shock. Interestingly enough, though, we had a poll this week. The most important consideration for me in the EU referendum vote is either the economy or immigration. 30% said the economy, 70% said immigration, and that's 2,000 people voted on that.
Which leads on to, we've had, haven't we? We've spoken about it on this show in the past. The OECD, the Bank of England, technical recession we might have, the ECB, the IMF, the Treasury, Barack Obama, everybody coming out saying what economic disaster it's going to be if we leave. Is it just, Rachel, you think, we don't really care about the economic argument? Is that fair to say, or is it just not winning us over? What is not capturing us, or is immigration just too potent right now for certain people?
It's both, isn't it? Perhaps that's not the thing that concerns people most. Perhaps they just don't buy it as well. I mean, for every think tank, financial body, politician who comes out and says doomsday for the economy, there'll be someone who comes out from the other side and says they would say that, wouldn't they? And that's just totally not going to be the case. And when we talk about these falls in the pound, it sounds pretty gloomy, doesn't it? And it certainly is gloomy if you're going to Spain on your summer holidays. Mm-hmm. But there are other reasons why it may not necessarily be that bad a thing for the economy in the long term. We don't know. We don't trust pollsters in the same way that we did before this last election either. That sort of, I think, is contributing to these fluctuations. We're seeing falls in the pound, but what we're seeing that's just as interesting are incredible fluctuations. You know, it'll be up 1%, down 1% in the same day, and on sort of the tiniest little crumb of news, because there's that level of uncertainty. We don't trust the pollsters in the same way, and also this is just unprecedented. For the pollsters to get it right, just a lot more difficult than the conventional elections that we have. Speaking to someone at Ipsos Mori last week, who said that they can't even do exit polls this time round, because exit polls rely on you looking at the key seats and comparing the outcome in those places to the election before. We don't have an election before, so we won't know until, you know, the very last minute. And in the meantime, we're going to see these fluctuations, and we just have to live with it, I suppose.
Well, the good news is the Bank of England, together with other government departments and public bodies, are now in what's called purdah, meaning they can't make any further comment on the potential impact of Brexit before the vote. But that doesn't mean other people can't comment. No, no, no. We've also been hearing this week from Britain's Chartered Surveyors that Brexit fears are hitting house prices, but I don't think the property market is going to get more affordable. Here's Martin Ellis, housing economist at Halifax.
If you look at what's driving the market on the demand side, people still benefiting from economic activity growing, employment still rising, people's earnings are rising faster than inflation, and interest rates remain very low. And you combine that with an acute shortage of properties available for sale, and that's not improving. There's still a vast shortage, both in terms of second-hand properties, but also in terms of new build. And we're putting that demand and supply sort of equation together, and it's still forcing up prices at what is a fairly brisk pace in terms of annual rates. Dig a little bit deeper into the figures and don't just concentrate on the annual change. And we like to have a look at what's happened in the last 3 months compared with the previous 3 months. Now, on that quarterly rate of change, we've actually seen quite a slowdown in April and May compared to where we were earlier on in the year. And that rate's effectively halved from around 3% to now around 1.5%. So it'll take a little while before that's translated into the annual figures. But I think we'll see that forcing its way through, and we'll see a slowdown in that annual rate over the next few months.
Simon, tell us more about this. What are your thoughts?
Well, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, keeps going around telling people that if we vote to leave the EU, house prices will fall. And because it's possibly a bit closer than anybody thought it might be that we might vote to leave the EU, people who were considering buying houses, especially expensive ones, where they face huge costs to move due to stamp duty imposed by that Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, are holding fire because they think that those houses might get cheaper if we vote to leave the EU, largely because people like the Chancellor have been going around telling them that if we vote to leave the EU, houses might get cheaper. And I think that when you get into that kind of scenario, people do have a tendency to sit on their hands. Mm. So it's been a bit of a slowdown, which has been exacerbated by the fact that there was a huge rush in the months between January and March from buy-to-let landlords snapping up property before stamp duty was hiked by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne. So I don't know where you point the finger of blame at for this, but you can draw your own conclusions.
Well, sticking with that theme, talking of buy-to-let, what must have felt a bit of a hammering of late, finally some better news for landlords in a David and Goliath, one might call it, case that went all the way to the Court of Appeal. The West Bromwich Mortgage Company is to refund £27.5 million to thousands of landlords after it increased its charges for buy-to-let tracker mortgages. What's one of those? Well, here's our very own senior analyst, Ed Bowsher.
So a tracker mortgage is where you get a mortgage where the interest rate is linked to the Bank of England base rate. So you might sign up for a mortgage which is base rate plus 2%. So right now the Bank of England base rate is 0.5%. If the deal was base rate plus 2%, you'd therefore be paying a 2.5% interest rate on your mortgage. And normally you'll sign up for that deal for a period. It might be 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. If you were signed up on a five-year deal, then you should get that base rate plus 2% for 5 years. And that, what would now be in that example, a 2.5% rate, that would only change during the five-year period if the base rate went up or down. If the base rate rose to 1%, the interest rate you paid on your mortgage would rise to 3%, because it would now be base rate 1% plus 2%. That's 3%. But it could be a base rate plus 3% deal, a base rate plus 1% deal. Just depends on the deal you're offered by your lender.
OK, so that was Ed Bowsher there. So why in 2013 did West Brom raise their rate by 1.9%? As many as 6,500 landlords with multiple properties now stand to be refunded, on average, a sum of more than £4,000. Simon, tell us what's going on here.
Look, the West Brom basically said that there were extenuating circumstances that meant that they had to, you know, raise this money, the raise these rates due to, you know, higher capital requirements, but also the cost of money, you know, on the money markets, basically. In the background, the stuff that normal people don't know about, the plumbings of the financial system, meant money was more expensive. So they hiked the rates on these people. Now, a tracker mortgage, as Ed says there, it follows, it tracks the thing it's meant to track. You take out a tracker, normally against the base rate, and it follows the base rate by X percent. Quite why West Brom thought it was okay to rip up the rules of the tracker mortgage and say that it was suddenly going to hike them, I don't know. But we criticised them heavily at the time. It doesn't matter if there's a little bit in the small print that they think says they can do this. You shouldn't do that. If someone has taken out a mortgage on a certain principle, you cannot just rip up the rules of that principle. It's just wrong.
But
it's
went
not,
all
it's
the way
not,
to the Court of Appeal.
It's not ethical.
There were
basically
loads of the financial ombudsmen, the other courts that said this
because,
is okay.
Because West Brom was right. There was a little bit in the small print that said that they could claim extenuating circumstances and do that. And so the financial ombudsman did say, well, look, there is this little bit in there. But it doesn't show the FOS and the FCA in a particularly good light. It shows West Brom in a particularly bad light. And it also shows that basically there's going to be plenty of emphasis put on, as it should be, the headline terms and conditions, and what your understanding of those is, not something buried in the small print. And the only other thing I would say is this, is West Brom hiked this rate. Other mortgage lenders also hiked their standard variable rates at the time, blaming these extenuating circumstances. Since then, those extenuating circumstances have kind of gone away, and money is dirt cheap at the moment, and you haven't seen any of those standard variable rates being brought back down. And banks and building societies that did that to their customers and haven't brought the rates down subsequently are ethically in a very, very difficult position.
But legally, do you think this is going to have more cases like this? Is it just West Brom that's going to pay out, or do you expect others potentially?
Well, David Lawrenson, who's a property expert who runs a site called lettingfocus.com, I mean, he says that, you know, this could have an impact for Skipton and Bank of Ireland as well, who in the past got away with similar hikes.
Now, just to calm yourself a little bit, please, Simon. Lovely. Bit of culture on the show. We do love that pound in our pocket here on Consuming Issues, and also a spot of classical music. Why not? Now, you got a letter this week from a very excited reader who thought they'd found a mint after getting a Benjamin Britten 50p coin in their change. JP wrote to you, "My dad told me to keep hold of it as they're rare and fetch quite a bit of money. I searched the coin on eBay and found some examples of it being listed for thousands of pounds. Have I hit good fortune, or is it a red herring?" Rachel?
Quick answer. It's worth 50p.
Oh, well.
It's a shame, isn't it? Although, something is worth whatever someone will pay for. So if anyone who is advertising one of these Benjamin Britten 50p's on eBay for £3,000 gets that from someone, then that's precisely what it's worth. However, you can also buy one on eBay for 50p, so you would be a bit of a mug to sort of scroll down through the cheaper ones and pick one that's worth £3,000. Nice try, though. It's quite similar to one that we had a couple of years ago, a Kew Gardens pagoda on a 50p coin, but a much smaller number of those were minted, and so actually they were worth a few hundred pounds at the time. So it's not a completely farcical, ridiculous question, but the answer is still 50p.
How interesting, you saying there that something is worth whatever you're willing to pay for it. Probably the answer of most CEOs around the country and around the world, indeed. Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from This Is Money. Thank you so much for joining us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.